Welcome to another edition of Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein. It's safe to say that Rosanna DeMaria is a heavyweight, lawyer, executive, management consultant, and coach. Her more than 20 years of business and management experience has taken her from government. She was chief of the Organized Crime Narcotics Unit for the New York City DA's office to the private sector, where she was senior VP of Enterprise Risk Management at AT&T, first vice president of leadership and performance at Merrill Lynch, and now founder and principal of the DeMaria Group. Her company works to build high-performing leaders and organizations through customized, transformation-driven consulting. Its products, services are not only designed for corporate executives, but for pro athletes and performers. Rosanna is also the chief learning officer and adjunct professor for New York University's Leadership and Human Capital Management program. So to summarize, Rosanna's put a dent in organized crime, held top executive positions, and impacted the leadership skills and decision-making of countless high-level executives. So on that note, let's meet this mover and shaker. Rosanna, welcome, and thanks for joining me today.
Good morning, Sandy.
So who is the real Rosanna DeMaria?
Well, thank you for the wonderful introduction, but to set the record straight, I really am only 107 pounds and 5'2".
So, okay.
The real Rosanna DeMaria is a passionate woman who believes that her mission will be complete when she leaves the world a better place. I don't think I would have said that 20 years ago, but I'm saying it now.
What's wrong with the world, in your opinion?
Oh, I think the world is a wonderful place. I just think we can all make it a lot better. And, you know, when you start your journey in your 20s, particularly if you're a young lawyer, success looks very differently than when you're 59 looking back.
So where were you when you were getting out of law school? Were you hoping to change the world? And if so, in what way?
You know, it's kind of interesting. When I started law school pretty much had me by default. My choice was either to go for my PhD in American literature and write the great American novel and teach college, or go into a courtroom. And after an awful lot of soul searching and teaching my way through graduate school, I applied to both graduate programs for a PhD and law school. And then I came to the reality that I wasn't going to write the great American novel. I just didn't have the talent for it. And absent that, I needed something more. I really am passionate about solving problems, and I love communication, and I love changing things. The crucible of the classroom allows you to do that in a very real way with your students. The crucible of the courtroom allows you to do it also, but in a very different way. For me, trying a case was all about trying the facts to 12 people in that jury box while you're arguing the law to some person sitting on a bench wearing a black dress while your adversary is shooting at you.
Mm-hmm.
For me, that was a very exciting experience. I wish I could say that when I started my career as a prosecutor, I was really focused on being a public servant and doing good. I was not adverse to that, but the reason I became a prosecutor was I wanted to try cases, and I wanted to try a lot of them fast. My choice was going to a law firm, and in fact, I had an offer from a law firm on Wall Street, and I had an offer from the Nassau County DA's office.
That's on Long Island, for those who don't know.
And I chose the Nassau County DA's office because I would get into the courtroom right away. And in fact, I did. Of course, it was in traffic court, Sandy, so
right. Speeding tickets. But what's interesting is that it was criminal court, not civil court. So where did that come from?
Well, you know, that was the really interesting part of my choice. I could have done civil law with that law firm, or I could have gone in to criminal law. The attraction for me of the district attorney's office was that you got into court right away. And the notion of a pretrial discovery and all of that process that happens in civil litigation isn't there with the same volume in criminal work. And in the DA's office, pretty much they throw you in the water right away. That's what they need to do. So you start in traffic court where you're actually trying speeding tickets, and you learn how to put in expert testimony on the the speeding machine and all that good stuff. And then you graduate to misdemeanors and then from misdemeanors to felonies. And then if you're really passionate about it, and I became very passionate about it, while my entry into prosecution was because I wanted to try cases right away, I fell in love with it and began my learning journey on how you could make the world a better place by getting the bad guys. And the bad guys took many different forms. And as you said, you know, at the end of my journey, I was chief of organized crime narcotics for Robert Morgenthau in Manhattan, where I was doing global narcotics and money laundering conspiracies. My areas of expertise included electronic surveillance, complex conspiracies, and some really, really interesting investigative techniques. So while I entered it to try cases, I left it having grown tremendously and learned an awful lot.
Well, I'm curious, how many females were doing what you were doing back then? And give us a time frame.
I joined right out of law school, and that was 1981. And there weren't a lot of us back then. There are a lot of us now in prosecution, but back then in Nassau County, there were two other women in my incoming class. There were probably a handful in the office. And to give you an idea, we were different. And it was very clear to everyone around us we were different because we were women. When I got to court and was able to try those cases, it was actually quite exciting. You're sitting at a table and you stand up and the court asks, are the people ready? And you say, the people are ready, Your Honor, Rosanna DeMaria for the people. And suddenly you're standing up doing things saying objection and people are listening to you. Well, for the first 16 cases I tried, the judge said, gentlemen, approach the bench, when he wanted us to approach the bench. I wasn't a gentleman.
Obviously.
But I had the burden of proof.
You had the burden of proof to prove that you weren't a gentleman.
Yeah, I did. To myself, to the court, and to the lifelong learning journey. As a prosecutor, I had to prove my case beyond a reasonable doubt. That's a substantial burden. And suddenly I was faced with this amazing choice. I don't want to make the judge angry at me, but this is really awful. He's not noticing that I'm a woman. What is wrong with this gentleman approach the bench? They're not used to having someone in a skirt at the prosecution table or at the defense table for that matter. And so you start to take that journey where you start to have an internal dialogue in your head. Okay, Rosanna, he's not recognizing that you're a woman ADA, but wait a minute. He's seeing you as any other lawyer. He's seeing that you're as good as a man. This is great. This sort of rationalization happens when you really don't want to rock the boat, but at the same time, you know, that voice deep inside your head, the one that when you grew up listening to Helen Reddy, I Am Woman, feminism way back then, starts to really whisper in your ear, you're selling out. You need to do something about this. Are you going to do something about this? Well, 16 cases. I just approached the bench and thought, this is great. He sees me just like my adversary. On case number 17, I stood up and I still remember the judge, God love him. It was Judge Henry Kalinowski. And Judge Kalinowski was old enough to be my grandfather. And so I stood up and I turned sideways and I said, Your Honor, look closely. It was extremely bold. In retrospect, it was slightly insane, but it was the best I could come up with. And God love him, Judge Kalinowski looked at me and he started to laugh. And we approached the bench and he didn't say much about it. But that day, unbeknownst to me, was the day the judges had lunch together. In Nassau County, the judges would have a judges lunch once a month and they would share what they learned and do what judges do in bonding with each other. And Judge Kalinowski spoke about the incident at lunch. And he told me this afterwards. And then the most amazing thing happened, Sandy. The entire bench started saying, counsel, approach the bench.
Aha. Okay. That's excellent.
And
excellent.
That was a beautiful, beautiful moment because that bench was exclusively male at the time.
I'm sure. Now, what's curious to me is when you made the move from Long Island to New York City and you were named chief of the Organized Crime Narcotics Unit for the DA's office, were you at that time the highest ranking woman in that office?
Oh, Lord, no. No, no, no. In Robert Morgenthau's office, they had many more women than we had in Nassau County, but the size of the office is substantially different.
Sure.
You're talking about hundreds of prosecutors.
Right.
And you're talking of handfuls in Nassau County. For example, in Nassau County, the homicides department, and I ultimately made it to homicide. That's a big deal because when you're homicide, obviously the highest crime, taking a life, you in Nassau County, you're actually given a car with a siren. When there is a homicide, the prosecutor is called out to see to the scene so you can see the scene, evaluate it. You're in a better position when you catch the defendant because you can do your examination and investigation more thorough. You would go on homicide call for an entire week when you were a homicide prosecutor. In New York City, you would only go on call for 24 hours. That's a big difference in the amount of homicides in New York City versus Nassau County. In that similarly, in Nassau County, on a felony, there was no plea bargaining post-indictment back then. That means the defendant either pleads to the top charge or you go to trial. This was squarely in my wheelhouse because that meant I tried many, many cases. In New York County, you would plead a case right down to the trial date. The defendant would have the ability to plead, and in a plea bargain situation. That was really unique for me because I came into New York County with the same sort of standards on plea bargaining that I was taught in Nassau, only to find, oh my gosh, you're way too harsh. That's not the way we work here, ADA De Maria. We have greater volume. We have to be more flexible.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is Rosanna De Maria, who is a lawyer, an executive, a management consultant, and a coach. So tell us, Rosanna, how you made the transition from crime to business.
Well, it was actually crime that brought me into business. At the time, cell phones, do you remember way back, Sandy, when cell phones were probably the size of a small brick, or maybe not such a small brick?
Sure, I do.
In the early 90s, the cell phone companies were really starting to find their way as an industry. And a man named Craig McCaw had basically quilted together this amazing network, the North American Cellular Network, so that customers could roam on different systems. And as useful as those phones were to the good guys, the bad guys realized these phones are fabulous because the criminals thought you couldn't tap them because they're always moving, right? How is it possible you could tap a moving phone? And that's where I came in because one of my areas of expertise was wiretapping. Wiretapping, it's very difficult to get a wiretap order from a court. And that's the way it should be because it is the most invasive Fourth Amendment tool we have, at least in my opinion. So the law is very strict. I found that very exciting as a prosecutor because to be able to make my case to get a wiretap was intellectually challenging. I liked doing wiretaps because it was real-time crime. I could hear what the criminal was thinking because it was coming out of his or her mouth into their phone. When cell phones came into the criminal's hands, it was wonderful because they would be on the move with them. And I could figure out where the phone was because the phone is working through a cellular system and I could get the location of the bad guy. So when he's saying, you know, I'm here with the 400 nuns, and what he really means, he's there with 400 kilos of heroin. I can find out where he is and I'm in a good place. So criminals started to look at the cell phone technology and they figured out how to take a phone, take Sandy Klein's phone, her phone number and the identifying numbers in that phone and clone them into another phone. And in fact, they could clone Sandy Klein's phone into 500 phones, ship some to Miami, some to Houston, some to LA, the other source cities. And ADA De Maria now has a problem because there's real Sandy Klein who's a law-abiding, great citizen, and then there's about 20 dirtbags that are using her phone to do high-level narcotics and money laundering. Which phone do I tap? How do I figure out that there are multiples? How do I know which one is the real Sandy? So as you can imagine, the law had an awful lot of questions about whether they could even be tapped in the first place. And the industry hadn't really contemplated making them accessible for tapping. So long story short, I ended up figuring out perfectly legal ways to do it, convincing a court with very high scrutiny to let me do it. And I did the first cell phone taps in New York. That gave me insights into criminal organizations that were fabulous. That work brought me to the attention of Macaw Cellular, because they were getting very serious about all this fraudulent use. Needless to say, that Sandy Klein, good customer, was paying her bill, but she would get a bill that had all these other phones activity on it. And she would call Macaw Cellular and say, hey, wait a minute, buddy. I didn't make these 400 calls to Bogota. So they wanted to bring someone in to solve the fraud problem. And I was that someone.
And so you went to AT&T, right?
Yes. AT&T was in the process of acquiring Macaw Cellular. And I really had the privilege of working with some of the most visionary business leaders of the time. Just the interview process was crazy. Sandy, I never expected to go into corporate America. I was going to grow up, become a chief, which I did, and then become a judge. I mean, that's what I was going to do.
Are you disappointed that you didn't?
No, not now. Not now. If anything, my career journey has taught me that what you know right now, you really have to challenge and look beyond it. That's why I believe learning is transformation.
What do you mean by that? That sounds like, you know, you're throwing that out and I don't know what that means.
Okay. If you had to ask me what the most important thing that I think every performer, and by that I mean performer in corporate America, performer in the work you do as a performer in the workplace, the most important thing that defines a high performer from an average performer is that the high performer is always challenging themselves to look beyond what appears to be concrete in front of them and be willing to think about how could it be different? What am I missing? And is there an area here I'm avoiding because it's too painful or I'm a little bit afraid of failing? Being able to look at that landscape that I've just described and assess themselves against it. What can I learn from what I'm not seeing or from what I'm afraid to see in front of me? And then the journey changes. As I told you, I became a prosecutor initially because I just wanted to try cases. That was the choice. And then after I got in there trying cases, I discovered that there's more meaning than just getting in the courtroom and having the exciting experience of trying a case. The crucible of the courtroom taught me that people are important. Those witnesses I put on the stand, the witnesses I couldn't put on the stand, the homicide victims, the jurors who had to be convinced and do an amazing thing, pass judgment. The crucible of the courtroom developed me, and I fell in love with that learning journey and thought, wow, I want to run a unit. I did run a unit. I became the chief of organized crime narcotics. And then I thought, ooh, I think I want to wear that black dress. I want to be a judge. Macaw Cellular comes along and says, hey, we're building this industry. We need to solve this problem. We don't know. We're not being successful doing it. We need someone who will develop our fraud strategy, be our spokesperson with the legislature, with the industry, with our customers, and with the dirtbags. And we need somebody to develop a technological strategy and how to solve it. All of that was tremendously exciting for me. Taking the leap to that career versus the one I was on and had fallen in love with thanks to the crucible of the courtroom was at first very scary, but I met business leaders that were incredible teachers that basically swept me away. Even in the interviewing process, they swept me away.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is Rosanna DeMaria, who is a lawyer, an executive, a management consultant, and a coach. So let me ask you something. You're here, you have this, you know, pretty high-powered executive position at AT&T, and then you move over to become first vice president of leadership and performance at Merrill Lynch. These are New York City jobs, and we're talking via Skype with you in Malibu, California. How'd you get there?
That's a really good question.
I mean, Malibu's a far cry from Nassau County in Manhattan, for heaven's sake.
It sure is. I will always be a New Yorker. And I got here perhaps on the most profound learning journey of all of them. I married the love of my life, the man I met in law school, Alan Dinkoff. He was a year ahead of me. And he was much more successful in law school than I was. He was editor-in-chief of the Law Review, went on to be a partner in a law firm. Well, Alan, 2 years ago, got an offer to work for an amazing biotech company called Amgen. And their culture and their work was very attractive to him. And they are located in Thousand Oaks. So two of the most dyed-in-the-wool New Yorkers in the world, my husband and I, had a hard choice. Could we come to LA? And I'm here. My work in my performance consultancy, though, can be done anywhere.
When you moved to California, had you started your own company at that point, or was that?
Oh, yes. I started my practice in 2004, and we moved out here in the fall of 2013.
So why did you start your own company? What was the point? You were doing pretty well working for other people. What was the genesis of the DeMaria Group?
I was working in Merrill Lynch, running their leadership and performance practice, and that position was in their HR group. And they had reorganized many, many times, and it just became clear to me that I wanted to do more. And I became a whole lot more passionate about taking my purpose to an impact. So I left Merrill and opened a solo practitionership. I don't have employees. DeMaria Group is Rosanna DeMaria. It's a group because when I take on a very large project, I sometimes enlist colleagues that I have strategic partnerships with. But essentially, I'm a sole proprietorship. And I do the work I love for the clients I care about. And that work is transformation.
Well, who's calling you, Rosanna? Who wants your services?
The kinds of clients who hire me are leaders who are really committed to redefining the future of their industries and their professions. They are performers who are insatiable learners. They truly believe that it's all a learning journey. And they won't accept anything less than high performance in their results from themselves or from their organizations. In many ways, they're just like me. They're about transformation and taking themselves beyond the edge of their potential. I'm really privileged to work with clients who are passionate about their businesses and the people in those businesses. So I essentially come at it from two angles, Sandy. I'm very good at looking at a business and understanding its inflection points or junctures for success. So I can restructure or improve a business from its organizational perspective. The people perspective, I'm very good at taking people from where they are now to where they need to be to take themselves beyond the edge of their potential and performance. I'm not for everybody. My approach in performance consulting is highly bespoke to the businesses I work with. I'm working with quite a few businesses that you'd recognize, and the sectors I work across are, not surprisingly, technology and telecommunications and financial services to areas like law firms. And I have done work with professional athletes, and I'm passionate about working with kids. That's the nonprofit part of my work. I love to spend time coaching high school students and college students, much in the way I do my executives. But that work is my nonprofit sector.
What do you coach them in?
Oh, I coach them in how to lead. And in the high school arena, we do it usually in the frame of helping them do their college interviews. Typically, high school athletes who are hoping to get scholarships, who want to present themselves to coaches on why them versus somebody else. College students, it's usually getting ready for the next leg of their journey.
I'm curious as to whether or not a lot of your work today involves women in the workplace. Or is your focus on females?
I have a very decent focus on women leadership because I've lived it, right? I do teach it. When I'm not working in my performance consultancy, I teach for NYU Schools of Professional Services. I teach in their Leadership and Human Capital Management graduate program. And one of my favorite courses there is Managing Inclusion and Cultural Diversity. And that course has a whole segment on women leadership. In the workplace, as we know from the good work of Sheryl Sandberg and Sylvia Hewitt, the women's leadership issue has not gone away. I feel very passionate in the work I do for women. And what I'm most proud about is the people who hire me to help develop women. And the people who hire me to help develop their women executives are more often than not exceptional male executives who truly are committed to women's leadership, but they don't know quite how to coach women or develop women. Because it's a little bit different than developing their male colleagues. I really respect that in the C-suite executives who have hired me to say, look, I've got Rosanna. She reports to me. I have managed women in the past. I want to bring Rosanna to the next level. I think she's, you know, potential successor to me. But I have a great relationship with her, but I can't bring her as far as I think you can if you work with both of us. I feel really passionate until we get to the point, Sandy, where we can hold a women's leadership course that includes men. We are not going to be there.
Is that going to happen?
I hope it happens in my lifetime.
Do you feel encouraged?
Oh, I feel very encouraged. If you were to ask me who had the most impact on teaching me along my learning journey, the majority of those mentors are men.
And well, that's all there men. Was, though, Rosanna.
Well, there are a lot of people who find that surprising.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
You mean as opposed to men thwarting you?
Exactly.
But there really were only men, for the most part, above you or who could mentor you, huh? No pun intended.
No, I think that's a fair statement, but there were women. There were absolutely women along the way, and they weren't always helpful. Part of the reason was I was a little bit different. The kind of woman who would stand in a courtroom, turn sideways, and say, look closely, Your Honor, is not your average bear.
Right.
Now, I didn't know that at the time, and it probably wasn't the most profound response, but it was just Rosanna being Rosanna. And I think the humor allowed it to have an impact that created a teachable moment for Judge Kalinowski and ADA DeMaria that neither one of us completely understood the profundity of at the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can sit here now and tell you with all that I have studied in organizational behavior and all that I know from experience is the use of humor allows adults to imprint a learning easier because it makes it safer. Did I know that then? Hell no, right? Mm-hmm. I know it now and I use it very much in both my classroom and in the boardrooms and in the conference rooms that I work in.
Well, Rosanna, I really enjoyed meeting you, and I have to share with you that we've run out of time. And I know there's a lot of territory that we could still cover, but it sounds to me like you're just in the place that you want to be. And I don't even mean Malibu-wise. And it sounds to me like you're doing really good work.
Thank you so much, Sandy, for those kind words. And thank you for having conversations with creative women.
Well, thanks so much for joining me today. I really enjoyed meeting you.
Thank you for having me. I enjoyed thinking out loud with you, Sandy.
Join us for another edition of Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein.